Session number 11512, reel 3.
Major Watson, reel 3.
Yes, I was making the point that we had this navigational exercise in the desert in which we were going to use the Kohl Sun compass. And the exercise was going on a triangular course. We went from point A, so many miles, to point B, from point B, so many miles, to point C, and then from point C back to point A. And this was done by measuring out on the map the direction by degrees, compass degrees, in which you were going to travel for that number of miles, and then changing the direction when you got to point B and going on a certain number of miles on a different bearing. And it was my job to have worked out this triangular course, the distances and the directions. And bear in mind, we are operating in an area which is quite featureless. There are no points of reference. It's just a great flat plain of sand and scrub and small stones. So we set off from point A, Watson in the leading truck, the battalion. This is a remarkable sight. A battalion, a brigade, on the move in the desert. It's like a huge convoy of ships at sea, extending, it seems, for miles. An astonishing sight. Anyhow, there I was in front in the navigational truck. We came to point B after the specified number of miles on the specified direction. All the company commanders joined the battalion headquarters truck and say, right, Peter, where are we? So Watson says, we're here. No, we're not there, we're here. I think there must have been three or four different opinions as to where we were. Anyhow, and at this time I was 20, I think, or 21. I stuck to my guns, because I was also impressed with these chaps. They were impressive men from, that's a horrible expression, but from a slightly kind of higher, shall we say, caste or class of society than myself. And I find it difficult to say no when they were saying yes, but anyhow, I stuck to my guns. So off we went from point B to point C, stopped, the kind of same disputation. No, we can't be, no, we're so-and-so, so-and-so. And anyhow, Watson stuck to his guns from point C back to point A, and with what enormous relief did I find that I was right. I don't know what would have happened to my subsequent mental position in any position where decisions were required, or indeed my military career as IO, if I had been wrong, or if I had not stuck to my guns and allowed myself to be swayed by what these other officers were saying. Anyhow, that was a feeling of, well, it gave me a certain amount of confidence, and it was a certain achievement.
What did the troops think of living in the desert?
The jocks, and I can only basically speak principally of Scottish soldiers, although we had quite a number of Englishmen in the battalion eventually with casualties, were most adaptable. Put up with anything, as long as they were treated well, as long as they felt that you were interested in and looked after their welfare, they would put up with anything. A remarkable breed, long-suffering, moaning. If they stopped moaning, you knew there was something wrong. They're truly a remarkable bunch of men. The jocks in the 7th Battalion were largely miners from Fife, and you couldn't wish for a better bunch of people with whom to go to war. Tough, hardy, as I say, adaptable to anything, prepared to do anything, and our first concern was naturally with them, and ourselves second. That in fact was the great thing. I believe in, well, I believe in all regiments, but certainly Scottish regiments. Men first and officers last. One lovely description that the Jocks gave of the desert was miles and miles of sweet fuckaw. I apologise for using the word, but it would it wouldn't convey the shall we say the canny humour of the expression without it.
Can you take me through the Battle of Alamein now, as you remember it, step by step in detail?
We went down during the day of the 22nd of October from the area in the north of the Alamein line to the south, and we came back on the night of the 22nd in the dark, although there was a moon, subsequently known as Monty's Moon, to the area in the north from which we were going to advance at the Battle of Alamein on the 23rd, so that we were, before daylight on the morning of the 23rd, in position in the front line or just behind the front line in Alamein. A most remarkable transformation had been created days, weeks before in this area, in that vast numbers of holes in the ground had been dug, duvers, slit trenches, open kind of hollowed out areas, some of them covered with tarpaulin, in which we were all, and don't forget we're talking of three divisions now with supporting troops, we were all to be lagered up during the whole day of the 23rd without the presence of such a large number of troops supporting artillery, machine guns and tanks being evident to the enemy. The camouflage was absolutely superb. We were forbidden to make any moves out of these holes during the whole of the day, and it was pretty damn hot. You can imagine in what way the Jocks would describe the heat and the discomfort we were undergoing. As the IO, it was my job to receive the latest sitreps or situation reports regarding the German defences, about which new information was being constantly acquired, principally at this stage by aircraft reconnaissance, although in some cases by patrolling. Patrolling would have been done previous nights. Of the development or new German machine gun positions that had been put in place or just discovered. And having acquired these, it was then my task to go around the various company commanders and acquaint them of the latest up-to-date position on their front of the defences, the enemy defences, that they would like to meet. So I was permitted to move about, but one of the few. I shall never recall, I think it was Charles Cathcart's company, C Company. Charles subsequently commanded the 7th Battalion when James Oliver left in Sicily. And he wryly said to me, "Peter, I wish you wouldn't come here bearing such good news. Next time I see you, I hope it's not to tell me there are more enemy machine gun positions on my company front." The day passed. Food we had carried with us, and it was obviously cold. I don't think we had even been able to have our favourite drink, hot sweet tea, so we would be drinking out of water bottles, but of course we had to enter the battle with a full a bottle of water, a full water bottle, and also with the 48 hours rations. So obviously administrative arrangements have been made to have food and drink of some kind that wouldn't eat into these essentials that we had to carry with us into the battle, because no one knew how long it would be before new supplies of food, etc., came up. Well, somehow the day passed. Well, how, in what kind of mental state were we? Physical state, we were exceptionally fit and hard bitten and bloody uncomfortable in the heat. I don't think there was anything other than a feeling of, well, this is it. We're going to be committed shortly. And I think probably one's thoughts finish there, because who can apprehend what's likely to happen? Who can foresee the situations in which you're going to find yourself? Yes, there must have been a feeling of fear and trepidation, or apprehension is perhaps more true. Because we officers and the NCOs were in an easier situation perhaps than some of the jocks, because we did have things to occupy our minds as to, well, in my case, what enemy dispositions, new ones were coming up, making sure that the instructions about the speed at which we were going to move and the compass bearing we were going to move on were understood by everybody. So certainly in bloody good nick we waited for 0 hour. Timings, I think at 9:40 on the 23rd of October, a full moon or some time prior to that, we got up from our prepared concealed positions and moved forward. The organization of a battle such as Alamein, one just got to pause a bit and realize how fantastic and detailed it would have to be. Completely flat country. How many troops? 40, 50, 60,000 troops. How many guns? I forget how many guns there were at Alamein. How many tanks? All this in a not a very large area, to be concealed from the enemy, and yet somehow at a precise given moment in time to start moving forward to the start line from which the attack would commence. Various tracks had been denominated to various units to move towards the front line. They were Star, Moon, and I forget the other tracks. And these tracks extended some distance behind the line, because once you got closer to the narrow line or the narrow front in which the attack was going to be made, naturally this great amount of troops converged into a smaller area. An incredible piece of organization, an incredible piece of camouflage, and an incredible happening that it all came together. And at precisely whatever the time was, 9:40 in our case, we got up and we moved forward on our particular track towards the start line, which had been laid out by that wonderful and indomitable force. I think they did it, the Royal Engineers, whose mind-lifting parties had, I think, even prior to this, gone ahead of the start line when the sun had gone down and started to remove our own mines from in front of our own barbed wire defences. And one must say that that they would then move further forward to try and clear as many mines in no man's land as possible. And we had with us, I think we had our own RE units with their minesweepers, a kind of saucepan at the end of a long stick which was able to detect any metal under the ground. And the stick was attached to their ears by wire so that they could hear the presence of any mines. When you think of men going forward in no man's land in a flat area, listening, not for the shells, etc., coming over, although they were obviously in as great danger as we were, listening for the presence of a mine, and then one of the party, RE party with them, having to go and locate it, delouse it, that is, get out the mechanical parts of it and make sure it was safe. An amazing breed of men again. Moving up to the start line, we moved through the shadowy figures in the brilliant moonlight of 25-pounder guns. All over the place they were. And the gun crews waiting, their timing, of course, extremely crucial, waiting for the moment when they would start shelling the enemy forward lines. I shall never forget the stillness, the move forward of all these troops. We were all told to be silent, naturally, and going through the lines of these guns, which we're going to open up shortly. I can't clearly remember whether there were any tanks there or not, or whether the tanks were at that stage behind the artillery. But it was an amazing sight, and we shuffled forward silently. We had, as a battalion of the Black Watch, an identifying mark on our small pack, which was a two white tapes in the shape of a St. Andrew's cross, so that we were immediately recognisable to our own units, etc., and so that the man behind could, if the other chap got too far away, wouldn't have too much difficulty in following him, because it was very much a question of follow my leader then, and then once we were committed to the battlefield itself. A superb organisation, a remarkable event, a growing feeling of what? This is it. Let's get on with the job. What kind of things were we thinking about? Keeping quiet and making sure the NCO didn't say, shut up, you bugger. Or, I don't know. Anyhow, you got on with the job, up these tracks, came to the start line. We had, as I recall, two companies forward. I won't give the names because I could be wrong, but one company on the left, battalion headquarters, one company on the right, and then another company behind the forward companies. I think that was the formation. The battalion headquarters consisted of the CO, James Oliver, the adjutant, David Russell, and myself, Peter Watson, I forget whether the mortar chap Ian Foggy was there, the signals chap Sandy Simpson, he would be there. Anyhow, before the actual zero hour, I think, but timing can be got from history books, all of a sudden, just like that, that every bloody gun in the 8th Army opened fire. It was immediate and instantaneous. And I know subsequent photographs, war photographs, have shown this kind of arc of light from the sea going down to the south. But that's just like it was. Your tin helmet was almost blown off your head because we were close to the gun lines. Or perhaps the barrage started before we got to the start line, I can't really recall. But it was absolutely incredible. And although we must have known that guns were going to start firing, when they did start firing, and in such numbers, it was an astonishing happening. Absolutely astonishing. What was happening at the end of these shells, goodness knows. But of course, eventually, German counter-battery, i.e. firing against our artillery guns, would start. Then, zero hour. I can remember only one chap who I said, "You're a bloody fool." I saw taking a swig out of a flask of whiskey. I said, that's no way, because it is no way to prepare yourself for a situation like that. But it does show the degree of the different degrees of feelings and apprehension or whatever that everybody was experiencing, and everybody must experience in such a situation. Anyhow, came the time for us to start, and we moved forward in our measured pace. I still have a card I'd prepared for myself, which is covered in my own blood, incidentally, showing the paces at which we must go, for how long we must hold that pace, when we must halt while our artillery barrage adjusted itself, and then at what pace we were to continue for how many yards. I forget the total distance of between the Alamein line and the German and the Italian line, but let's say it was 2 miles. We had not long started advancing when the German and Italian artillery was firing on our artillery, counter battery fire, and then also began firing on us. No words can really... No words can ever paint a proper picture, because you can't transfer to somebody else something really truly unless they themselves were there or unless they've had a similar experience. But imagine a long line of men, New Zealanders, Highland Division Australians, moving forward at regulated pace through a completely flat bit of ground, no man's land, towards an enemy position which has got minefields in depth, isolated positions with machine guns in, more minefields, more isolated positions with machine guns in, more barbed wire, until you finally come to the main enemy position. Basically, a very flat plain, but towards the end of our advance, a slight undulations in the ground, pimples, but of course which did give a dominant field of fire. That is what we were about at the Battle of Alamein on the 23rd of October, 1942. Eventually, as you went forward, shells were falling all round about you. Machine gun bullets were flying all over the place. Tracer bullets could be seen firing here and there. And of course shells were landing, people were being killed, people were being wounded. Nothing stopped until your measured distance had been gone and you lay down until the time came to move forward again, and our own barrage, which was going in front of us, to try and wipe out the forward enemy posts, started again. Incredible. And lying down in that, as the jock would say, fucking shit going all over the place, it's astonishing. This is what discipline does, of course. This is what armies are about. The ability to do this and get on with the job. There were some mammoth explosions here and there because some very large bombs had been put in the sand with tripwires extending from them all round. And of course, although the moonlight was bright, the sand was being churned up by shells and everything else, inevitably somebody would actuate a tripwire. And these bombs would just explode and would take sections of 10, 15, 20 men with them, just like that, killed or wounded. At one stage, how were we dressed? Steel helmets, small packs on our back, water bottle on our belt, another small pack on the other side of our belt, in our hands rifle, bayonet, stuck behind our small pack on our back, and trenching tool. We had spade. We carried spades and picks with us because we knew we were going to have to dig in once we had got into the enemy positions. Yes, and then I think an entrenching tool also on the left, where I said there was another pack. Ammunition, of course, spare ammunition carried all over the place. Some men carrying the 2-inch mortar, some carrying the 2-inch mortar shells. Men carrying Bren guns, and their number 2 carrying spare ammunition. Grenades attached to our belts, or however we used to carry grenades, I forget, slung on our belts. Everyone was mobile firepower, and we were being shot at by all kinds of guns, artillery, these bombs that were going up, people treading on mines, because obviously all the mines could not be cleared. Oh yes, that was another thing. We had, as infantry, to be able, by using a bayonet prod, to find out the presence of mines, and we had also been given the ability to de-louse them. But apart from the initial clearing in our own minefield by the Royal Engineers, and the fact that a tank had been equipped with a big metal flail in front on a roller to go with us, and the idea was that this flail thing would detonate mines by their impact on the ground,